Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. This week, I'm excited to welcome Mike Koger to the podcast. Mike is an associate general counsel at Perkins & Will, where he advises one of the world's leading architecture firms. Before joining Perkins & Will, Mike spent over a decade at AIA Contract Documents, collaborating with attorneys and architects to shape the contracts that guide our industry. And before that, Mike was practicing architecture himself, giving him a rare dual perspective as both architect and attorney. And I'm looking forward to digging into his story and learning from his insights. Mike Koger, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. I'm really happy to be on and definitely listen to your podcast many times over the years and happy to finally be on here.
Great. I'm happy that you're here. I'm interested in our conversation here. We have an audience of thousands of architects. Lots of them are small firm architects, and they're always looking for answers about contract documents, whether they're AIA contract documents or other contract documents. And so I'm looking forward to that conversation, but I want to know more about you first. Law and architecture. So I want to know your origin story. When did you discover your passion for architecture and law? And who or what inspired you to get started with this whole thing?
Yeah, thank you. So I've definitely taken a few twists and turns through my career. I grew up in Indiana, in a kind of a small rural town in Indiana. I went to Ball State University for architecture school, quickly realized that there's not a lot of new construction going on in my hometown, and decided with a couple of friends that I had to move away from home in order to actually practice architecture. So I spent most of my early career in San Diego, California, working for a couple of different architecture firms, which gave me, I think, a good perspective on where my skills were as a young architect. The first firm I worked for was a really small firm. We did a little bit of residential work, but the bulk of the work that we did that really paid the bills was in like telecommunications, permitting. And that really got me involved in going down to building departments, understanding zoning codes, because like nobody wants a telecommunications site in their backyard, but they all want cell phone service. So I really got enmeshed with like the just legalese of like trying to get things permitted, trying to navigate the zoning issues at a very young age. And then I went and worked for a bit larger of a firm that did larger design projects. And I sat alongside, this is still when I was in my early 20s, I sat alongside people who were up and coming architects. And I realized I always thought I was a good designer until I started working right next to people who were amazing designers. And I realized pretty quickly that I'm never going to get that kind of design exposure, because on bigger projects that I went to architecture school for, those design projects were rightfully going to go to my peers who were exceptional designers. So that's kind of the bundle of factors that led me to go back to law school. Really during the Great Recession from 2006 to 2009, I went to Tulane University, studied environmental law, land use law, lived there right after Hurricane Katrina. And so that was kind of an interesting place to live for a time. And then ultimately graduated from law school in 2009 when no one was hiring new attorneys. So I kind of had to take whatever was available. And at that time, no one was really doing new design work. I mean, there weren't a lot of new projects just on the books, but everybody was kind of fighting about the ones that were you know, a few years old. And so I ended up doing construction defect litigation for a number of years before ultimately settling with AIA. So if you're just following on a map, I mean, I was from Indiana to California to Louisiana to California, and then eventually to Washington, D.C., and worked for AIA for about 11 years before finally last year settling with Perkins and Will. So kind of a circuitous route, but all along, I've really loved architecture. I mean, we were talking before we started the podcast, even on vacations, I go and visit like famous architectural sites. And, you know, I'm glad that I actually can finally represent architects at Perkins and Will.
What was it about law? I mean, how did you know that law was your path? You started as an architect, you realized that design wasn't for you, and there's lots of different places you could have gone as an architect. Why the path of law?
Yeah, good question. It was just more natural to me. You know, the design, the non-linear nature of design, that you don't just go step to step. You have to think more creatively. I was decent at it. I was good at it, but I wasn't great at it. And the legal way of thinking through things, of rationalizing things, of taking steps to like come to conclusions, and you still have to be creative as being an attorney, but it just came more natural to me than architecture did. And I knew I could be better at that than I could at architecture.
Yeah. So ultimately landed at AIA Contract Documents. Today you're at Perkins and Will, but you were at AIA Contract Documents for a long time. What was your role when you first got there at AIA?
Yeah, so I started at AIA back in 2013. And at that time, I honestly forget what my title was. I mean, I was like an associate level new attorney with them, although I had some experience. But I was basically supporting the Documents Committee, which is a standing committee of architects who are not your regular architects. These are people who commit to like work with the AI contract documents program for a 10-year period. And they're all people who are pretty senior in their firms, or they run their own firms, and they're very knowledgeable about contracts. So they're definitely not your average, you know, architect. They're people who are very knowledgeable. And I would support them in creating and updating the AIA contract document. So a lot of folks, I mean, I'm sure even before I started working for AIA, I knew that AIA had about, I would have guessed, oh, they've got about 50 documents or so that people regularly used. The reality is they have like 230 or so documents.
Wow,
and they're constantly creating variations. And a lot of times when I talk with folks who are practicing architects, they'll ask me, well, you guys should really develop a pro bono agreement. You know, something for when we're doing services for free. And it's like, well, we already did that like 10 years ago. And so there's a whole lot of documents out there that we are either updating, or back in those days, I was either updating or creating, that, you know, honestly, most people don't even know about, but are still useful.
Yeah, I was looking at the website, which is aiacontracts.com, to prepare for our conversation here. And it's completely different than the last time. You know, I haven't looked at it in a long time. And it's pretty in-depth. And it looks like you can find those documents pretty quickly on the website by sort of searching through different types of contracts or different types of buildings or different types of firms. You could filter them all out. And so of the hundreds of documents they have, I think today you could probably find those documents pretty quickly.
Yeah, you can. I mean, we've gotten better at making the website more usable. It's always kind of a tricky thing with like, you don't want to give people so many options that they're overwhelmed. And at times, like, AIA has definitely done that with the website, where here's like a million different options. Good luck figuring out which one is the right one.
Right.
But at the same time, you don't want to just steer people too narrowly into a path, because then that puts blinders on with regards to other things that might actually be useful. One thing that I think the AIA, and again, I don't work there anymore, but like we spent hours and hours of time as a committee working on guides that aren't contracts, but they have a whole lot of useful information in them. And then we publicize them to a good degree, but they don't get the same kind of recognition that the contracts do. And those guides can be just as valuable. And almost all of those guides are free online. So if you can find them, like if you want to, like a, for example, if you're doing condo projects, you really should not be doing condo projects without looking at the AIA's condo guide, because it gives you some, you know, risk management strategies from folks who've actually done it and been burnt on projects in the past. So
good advice. Our podcast here is typically talk from a business point of view, but the majority of our audience is also small firms. Perkins and Will is a huge firm, but you also come from small firms. So you've had the experience as a small firm architect. I'm working with a large firm and over a decade at AIA Contract Documents. Speaking to those small firm architects, what would you say are some of the things from an attorney's point of view? Not necessarily contracts. We can talk contracts too, if that's some of the things that you would talk about. But what are some of the things that our community of small firms, what should we be paying attention to from a legal point of view?
You know, I think a lot of times architects think that the AIA Contract Documents program is designed and intended for big firms like Perkins & Will. And realistically, that couldn't be farther from the truth. Perkins & Will, the Genslers of the world, not to name drop, but just the big architecture firms,
yeah,
they have in-house counsel. Like, I am one of quite a few attorneys that Perkins & Will has. Not quite a few, but we have a handful of attorneys, and they're all very skilled in negotiating contracts and writing contracts. Big architecture firms, they use AI contracts, but they don't need to because they have outside legal counsel that they have on hand or that they can hire from a private firm and get legal advice from. Really, the AIA is drafting contracts for small firm contractors, small firm architects, recognizing that, of course, everybody in the industry uses them. But I really think that the bulk of the, I don't know the statistics on it, but I would guess that the bulk of people that use AIA contracts are small firms. Probably the overwhelming majority are small firms, both architecture firms, engineering firms, and construction firms. As far as risks, things that architects should be paying attention to, I did a program about a month ago with a friend of mine at the AI conference. And in the lead up to that program, he and I polled 30 construction attorneys that we knew just to do like a little question and answer session with the audience.
Yeah.
And we asked these 30 attorneys, most of them are people who represent architects in some capacity. Like, what are some of the biggest risks that architects have? And what are architects' biggest weaknesses when it comes to risk management? And I shouldn't have been surprised to learn this, but the thing that stood out to me the most was that all of these construction attorneys, almost all of them said, architects are too nice. They're too nice. They are too willing to bend over backwards for their clients. They're too willing to say, it's okay if you haven't paid me for 60 days or 90 days. We'll figure it out later. You know, they're too willing to like concede to things that a contractor just frankly would not concede to. They're too willing to give away free services or to work on a handshake deal for way too long. And so if there's any advice to come from that, it's you can be firm and fair at the same time when you're dealing with an owner or a consultant. And another thing I noticed or took away from that was that a lot of architects don't necessarily want to be bothered by legal issues. And they think they can get away with a handshake agreement because it's worked many times in the past.
Right, right.
But it only takes one bad situation to ruin your firm, frankly, if you have a small firm and if you're not protected properly. And I've got a whole bunch of other like more specific things that I think that architects should be paying attention to in small firms. But I should also, you know, put a caveat here. I'm an attorney, but I'm only licensed in two states. The laws of every state are different. So the things that you're going to hear on this podcast from me really should not be considered legal advice. They're just kind of generalities that, you know, if you really have an issue, talk to somebody who's actually a lawyer in your state who's representing you.
Yeah, good advice. I definitely, when you started saying that architects are too nice, I could feel the head nods of the listeners who are listening and saying, yes, we are too nice. That happens all the time. Every time we get into trouble, it's because we sort of tried to do something that bit us, right? Tried to do something that we think would help the project or help the contractor or help the owner or make the project better, right? And architects get into trouble both legally and also business-wise, right? Because that also goes for billing and additional services. Architects are often giving their services away. And so that's interesting that your poll of construction attorneys, first thing, right? We're too nice. And that's great, right? It's also a blessing that we're nice. But we have to learn how to be nice and, you know, make sure that we're protected. Do you have any advice on how to do that? And that may not be even a legal question. It might be a psychological question, but do you have any advice on how architects can do that? Is it just about being more consistent?
Well, sure. I've got definitely a few thoughts. You know, the thing that you just said about additional services is a good example. Contractors don't do anything for free, right? They're not doing anything for free. They're going to make sure they get paid. And owners respect them for that. Look, the thing that you want me to move around here because you had a change in the way your business operates and it just doesn't make sense to have this configuration, it's going to cost extra money. That should not come as a surprise to an owner. And contractors will be upfront about that. And I represented contractors in this way. And they're just like, here's the cost for the change. We're not going to, you know, split it halfway with you or something because we're already in the space doing some work. So architects are kind of notorious for giving away services for free. And I think that partially comes down to like the fact that a lot of owners, even sophisticated owners, don't really know like what are traditional basic architectural services versus what are things that are like above and beyond. You know, like a lot of owners would think, well, if I'm working on an old building, like historic preservation services, all those kind of permits and extra analysis you might have to do, that's all just part of what an architect does, right? Not really. That requires a special expertise. It requires a different skill set from an architect. And there's a whole host of examples of that. In fact, I often have said that, like, if you look at B101, the main owner architect agreement, Article 4, which is a whole listing of things that are extras, that truly are not things that are basic architectural services. It's one of the best things that AIA has ever published. And it really should be a guide to like, it's things that like an architect can talk through with an owner and just say, here are the things that you get for a certain fee. And then all of these things, we can do them, or frankly, some of them, we don't know how to do them. If you're not a historic preservation expert, don't do those services. But these are all extra things that like we can bill extra for, but we're not just throwing them in as like a basic service. That's a difference between contractors. It's pretty obvious when a contractor is doing something extra. It's not always obvious to an owner when an architect is doing something extra. So just like educating your owner on all of these things right at the outset, if you're asking me to do them, they're going to be extra for me. And then just being upfront about it and sticking to it. You know, and if you give a good, it's my experience when working with owners, with clients, that if you give a good rational basis for why you're charging them extra or for why you are insisting on a particular risk mitigation feature in a contract, like a waiver of consequential damages or something, as long as you have a good basis for that, they're going to, you know, they're sophisticated. They hire attorneys too. They are willing to work with you on those things. They're not going to be insulted by the fact that you've tried to negotiate a contract or that you've stood firm on a position that you have a good reason to be firm on, you know.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, RCAT's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the Detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right. HSW credits for episodes of Detailed podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at rcat.com under the Resources tab. Or just go to rcat.com/arcademy. That's ARCAT.com/ARCATEMY. That's ARCAT.com/Arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. You're talking about setting expectations. First of all, using a contract, right? So you have a contract, so you have something to look at, some document to refer to. But once you have that contract, it's not just a legal document that you just stick in a drawer and wait until you need it. Using it right up front, like you were saying, Mike, to use it as a guide of this is the process. This is how we're going to go through this process before we start. Setting those expectations with the owner, saying, hey, this is what we do as our basic service. And here are all the extra pieces that you can hire us to do, and we will do them. And this is how we'll charge for them. And so you're setting all those expectations up front. So when it happens later in the project, it's much easier to come and say, hey, remember we had that conversation before we started? That's an additional service. And they say, yep, no problem. Totally understand that. The problems happen, right? And you as an attorney can, I'm sure, have stories about this, is when you don't set those expectations and you don't review the contract, and then you send them a bill and they're like, what is this? I don't even know what this is. This is, I didn't approve this.
Right.
And in fact, they did when they signed the contract, but the conversation was never done.
Now, you're absolutely right. The best way I've seen this done is not being delivered as a message through like an attorney like me. It's if you have somebody at your firm who's knowledgeable about the contract that you're expecting the owner to sign, and just sit down with them with the B101 and just say, here's what this says. This is the language that we have that talks about if we're going to be using building information modeling, here's what we design or we build that model out to be used for. And it's not going to be used for these other things because we've learned that that caused problems on our projects, on your project. Here's the provisions, the things that we are going to do as a basic service. Here's the level of like cost estimating. If you're doing that as an architect, here's the level that we're going to do it at. Or by the way, we might need to hire a new cost estimator because we don't do that stuff in-house. And just sitting down with them and using a contract like the B101 as a teaching tool and just walking through it with your owner. And if they have objections to it, well, then you can sort those kinds of things out. But I think the B101, if you think about it as a living document that has been around in some fashion for 100 years, and it is really it's a repository of information of like things in which architects have been burnt on in the past 100 years, right? And their lessons learned from the last 100 years of architectural practice. And if you just use that as a teaching tool to talk through with owners, I think that's very helpful. And bring in lawyers when you have to. But for the most part, that's a conversation that every architect should be able to have with their clients.
Yeah. And as I mentioned, we're talking to lots of small firms. AIA Contract Documents for years has had a small project suite that has documents that are specifically geared towards small projects and small firms. They're different than the B101. Having this conversation is very interesting because what I would say is, even if you're using the small projects suite, still review the B101 for yourself so you understand what's in it and what's not in the small projects. Is that right? Would that be good advice?
That's absolutely, that's great advice. Yes, the AIA does have, I keep saying we, that's like 11
I'm
years.
I'm sure it's a habit after a decade of being
we. It definitely
we.
Is. Yeah, and it's, I have not been working with AIA for, you know, we're going on a year, we're at 9 months or so, and I still say we, but you know,
yeah.
we
yeah.
offer a whole bunch of different versions of like B100 series documents. So there is a B101, which is the traditional one that's been around for a long time. There's a B104, which is a bit abbreviated. B105 is even more abbreviated. And yes, if you're signing something that is a more redacted version, there are going to be protections that are useful things to you that might be stripped out of that B105 agreement, because I want to say that's like a 3 to 4 page document, and a
right.
traditional B101 is like 25 pages or so. So yeah, you should definitely be aware of the things that are not included in those smaller agreements, if indeed that's the one you want to go with, and still, you know, use talking points from the B100 series or B101 document. AIA also offers, you know, residential contracts. They offer contracts for like condo projects that are more specific to those particular types of the nuances of those types of projects, which in some ways can cause more risk. So yeah, they offer a ton of contracts. I tend to kind of default back to talking about the B101 just because it's the one that's been around forever.
Right. Yeah. Well, I want to make sure that small firms know that there are alternatives to that, because a 25-page contract for a residential addition is overwhelming.
Sure. Well, one thing I'll say to the listeners here is that, like, while I understand that, like, as an architect who's working on a small project, you don't want to overwhelm a client by throwing some big meaty document at them, but it's not necessarily the amount of words or the amount of pages that should be scary to an owner. It's what's in them. And I mean, I have created some of the, in private practice many, many years ago, when I was representing contractors and owners, some of the most lethal contracts that I ever created were 1.5 pages long. So just because a contract is short doesn't necessarily mean it's fair. But of course, I mean, at AIA, they always try to create documents that are as fair as possible. So you're on pretty good footing if you're using any of those contracts of any size. You know, at least as an architect, that anything in them is going to be insurable. You know, it's going to have at least some degree of risk mitigation in there for an architect that makes sense.
Were there any other points that we should be aware of in your presentation at AIA conference that you want to share with our audience?
Sure. Yeah, I'll give you a few thoughts. The folks that we polled almost uniformly said that talking to an owner about limitation of liability and trying to get a limitation of liability provision into your contracts is an essential like tool in an owner-architect agreement. And you're not going to find in like AIA standard documents limitation of liability provisions in most of those agreements. But if you look at the B 503. It's the supplemental conditions document. You can actually find some language that's very helpful. And I have definitely been a part of litigation on both sides of the matter where a limitation of liability provision has been able to get an architect out of litigation early. They've been able to settle early because they've been able to agree to like a maximum cap of liability for an architect. That can be a nice way to extract yourself and set expectations with the owner that like, look, I'm not putting my business at risk for every single project for uncapped liability. We're going to agree to like $1 million cap or $500,000 cap. I mean, that's not an unfair position when you're an architect to try to set expectations like that, because the reality for a lot of architects is that, you know, you get a relatively small fee for a project that's going to give you liability for up to 10 years. So if something leaks 9 years into the life of a building that you've designed, you're probably going to get sued for it. So that is a tough environment on which to like actually make money and run a business. And it shouldn't be offensive to an owner if you're trying to get a limitation of liability or if you're trying to get a waiver of consequential damages in your contract. Those are two features that can really protect an architect from claims that are just exorbitant and or claims that are wildly out of alignment with the kind of fee that you're getting. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, it does. The limit of liability. Can you just explain that a little bit for anybody who may not understand what that means?
Sure. It's a provision in a contract that says effectively that our liability is going to be capped at either a certain dollar amount or to the limits of available insurance that are required. So that, like, if you think about it, you could do a relatively small amount of work on a project. And if all of a sudden the owner wants to say, well, that caused all of these other bad things to happen, and then it shut down my project for 6 months, and we planned on making $50 million in this project the next 6 months, you know, we were going to rent it out right to high dollar clients, you know, like you could get a $40,000 fee that can potentially generate multi-million dollars of claims for you. So having a limitation of liability is just setting a reasonable cap on what your liability is going to be for all those unforeseen and exorbitant types of claims.
Yeah. And consequential damages are what you just explained, where what happened in your project caused other things, these dominoes to fall that created other liability issues that they're going to claim against you as well. And having these limits in your contract, when those things happen, the contract will limit how much they can claim. When it goes, if it goes to court, the court will look at that and say, well, you can't sue for more than whatever the limit is.
That's spoken like a true lawyer, Mark. Yeah. That was perfect. And that's exactly what it's trying to account for. But those two things, and particularly a waiver of consequential damages, should not be controversial to an owner. It's been standard in AIA contracts for both contractors and for architects for many, many years, dating back to the early 1990s, I think. And it's something that, as an architect, you really don't know. You know, I mean, if I'm doing design work on a like a conference center, like I don't know if that conference center is going to be vacant for the next 6 months after completion, or if you're going to have people who are paying a crazy amount of money to come in and host events there. Like, and so you can't forecast that as an architect, as a designer, you know?
Yeah. And one piece of advice is that you should have liability insurance. And with that liability insurance, often your insurance company will provide access to an attorney who will review your contract documents. And so those kind of questions about limits of liability and consequential damages and how to word those if you need to adjust them can be done through your access to the attorney with your insurance policy.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Use those resources because your PLI, you know, policies, they'll actually review contracts. You're absolutely right.
Today, you're working with Perkins & Will. What's your role today at Perkins & Will?
Yeah, so I'm an associate general counsel. Been working with Perkins & Will since November last year. And I mostly do contract reviews, negotiations for the Eastern region and some of their overseas projects as well. So I'm probably touching, you know, 4 or 5 contracts a day in some variety. Either I'm on phone calls negotiating contracts or, you know, I'm redlining contracts, those kinds of things. So that is pretty much my day to day right now.
In architecture, with the changes that are happening in technology with AI and all the different technologies that are coming up through the profession, what are some of the trends that you're seeing that some of these contracts are going to have to adjust to in the future? What are some of the things that we need to be aware of in terms of technology and AI in the future?
Good question. I can't say I have like a perfect answer to it, but I'll give you some thoughts. I mean, you know, most of the time, owners, particularly if they've done a number of construction projects in the past, they're going to want to own your intellectual property, or they're going to want to have a license to your intellectual property that's pretty durable. And so, and a lot of times what they'll require is that if you as the architect are going to make representations in your contracts that you are not infringing on other people's intellectual property, right? And if you are, if there's a claim, they want you to indemnify or to defend against those kinds of claims. So, you know, I know the world right now when it comes to AI being used in design is pretty murky. You know, if you are entering into an AI machine, you know, whether it's some of the ones that like ChatGPT, I know it can spit out some like amazing images, but if you're telling it to like copy styles or to use styles of other architects who are around, and then you're incorporating those, it gets into some real gray area as to whether or not you've stolen their intellectual property in some way. And I mean, as architects, every architect is using design elements from other architects, but I think it's a little bit different to like tell an AI machine to like spit out something that looks just like a Norman Foster building or something. I think you can run into some like problems there. So
yeah,
I haven't seen that addressed in contracts, but it's definitely something that as practitioners, like architects should be aware of. And then as far as like any kind, you know, if I'm thinking back to like my early days of doing architecture work, you know, I'd have to sit and look through like the city of San Diego's like zoning codes in order to figure out what we can do, right? Like where are we allowed to build and how high and whatnot.
Right. Yeah.
Nowadays, I'm sure that I've heard, I hope, you know, that people are just running the zoning code through an AI machine, a bot, whatever, and then it's spitting out like the requirements back to you, or it's summarizing them in some way.
Yeah.
The bottom line is that like the state that you're in, one thing I'm very certain of with regards to this is the state that you, whatever state you're in, they license individuals to practice architecture. They do not license some AI machine like ChatGPT to practice architecture. So if you're giving advice on zoning based off of some output that's been created by like ChatGPT to summarize something, then you need to make sure that you're have your eyes and your professional like review on that output to make sure it's correct, because you're not going to be able to say it's going to come of no consequence that you got it from ChatGPT. It's literally going to be you as the architect or the one that actually summarized it and used it. So there has to be that level of human, I guess, overlay on any kind of analysis, you know.
At the end of the day, we are responsible, right? We're liable. So whatever tools we use, you better make sure that they're providing accurate information. AI is certainly one of them in terms of research with zoning and building codes. That happened exactly to me. My son just bought a house. He was thinking about using it for an Airbnb short-term rental. And we just did a really quick zoning search to see if it was permitted in the neighborhood that he bought in. And it gave us all of this information, very detailed parameters about how many Airbnbs were permitted within a certain footprint, right? They had to be a certain distance from one another, and you had to go to the building department to find out where the other ones were. And so I kept asking the tool to come back and say, well, where did you get that information?
Yeah.
And it would send me to the zoning code, but the section that it was referencing wasn't in the zoning code. And so I'm like, no, it's not there. Show me where you're good. So, and then finally I said, send me a PDF of what you're referring to. And it sent me a PDF of meeting minutes from 2022 where they discussed this law that never was enacted, but it presented it as fact and as zoning. And that's a simple, you know, inconsequential situation. But imagine if I went to a client and gave them that information because AI told me that that was the information. And, you know, they ended up spending thousands of dollars worth of time going through that process to find out that it doesn't exist. AI could be very, very helpful, but it can really, really be damaging if we're not careful.
Well, good for you for at least asking the follow-up questions. I think a lot of folks would have just said, well, it says we can do this. Let's buy the unit, you know, whatever. I mean, but it's a good point that like, if you really drill down and ask and look into the background of how these AI machines are created, how they generate their information, they'll even tell you like that it's current as of like 2024,
yeah,
you know, or something like that. And it's like, zoning codes are updated regularly, particularly the regulations around like how Airbnbs are used.
Right.
Like that stuff is updated on a very regular basis.
Right, constantly. Yeah.
Pretty scary though, that they're actually giving you something like a firm commitment about a law that is just based off of meeting
minutes. It presented
it
as fact zoning. This is the zoning. And with zoning numbers and everything, it gave me the section and everything, but the section didn't exist.
Oh my.
It was never ratified. It was a good lesson, very harmless, good lesson for me.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of tools that companies are using AI and developing these tools to be useful tools for us as architects. They're doing the extra work to make sure that they're accurate and consistent. And so, you know, one of the things we should be doing is looking at those dedicated tools rather than just using a chat bot, making sure that the tools are actually vetted, so that we know that the information that's coming from them is accurate.
It's a good point. If you go to like trade shows, and I've gone to quite a few of them over the last few years, there's no shortage of like new tech out there. Everybody's trying to break into the construction industry. And
dozens of them, yeah.
And I'm sure, I know you've interviewed folks, you know, in the past. So
many of them, yeah.
Trying to figure out like as an trying to navigate that landscape nowadays as an architect who ultimately you're the responsible, you know, or in responsible charge of your project as a designer, and which tools you can rely on and to what degree. It's a tricky place to be for an architect, I think.
Yeah. And we have to embrace the AI tools, right? Because that is our future. And so the sooner we embrace them and the sooner we learn how to use them, the better we'll be. But we have to be careful while we're doing it because we are, you know, responsible and liable. This is a great conversation, Mike. I'd like to wrap things up with my final question. You've been a small firm architect. You're working for a large firm now. You've worked with AIA contracts for over a decade. What would you say is the one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Well, one thing, I guess I'll be a little bit of an optimist here with one thing, because I could probably say a whole lot of pessimistic, beware of this, beware of that, don't do this, don't do that stuff. And that's usually when I give presentations, that's usually what I'm saying. Be careful of this, be careful of that. A colleague of mine likes to use the phrase, a ship is safest in harbor, but that's not what ships are for. So you can protect yourself. You should protect yourself as an architect. You should have good contracts. But at the end of the day, you got to go out there and do business. And the business world is, it requires you to take some risks and it requires you to get a little bit dirty. Contractors are very familiar with this. They take risks that are, sometimes they take risks that are uninsurable. And so I wouldn't, just because you've got attorneys like myself and others who you might consult with that say, be careful a lot, do this, don't do that, that doesn't mean you shouldn't go out there and take risks, because ultimately you're not going to have a successful business if you turn down projects right and left because they're too risky or because you're afraid of a big claim. Protect yourself as much as you can, but take calculated risks.
Yeah, great advice. I mean, if you protect yourself, then you can go and take those risks, right? Because you've
absolutely,
you have done the work to protect yourself. And that's how successful businesses are built. That's what Entree Architect is about. Entrepreneur architects, you know, entrepreneurs go out and take risks in order to build businesses to make the world a better place. And so, excellent advice. I appreciate that. His name is Mike Koger. His firm is Perkins & Will. PerkinsWill.com is the website if you want to check out what Perkins & Will is doing these days. AIA contract documents can be found at AIAcontracts.com. And so go check them out. And Mike, thank you very much. This has been a great conversation. I appreciate you for coming by here and sharing your knowledge on Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. It's been fun.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link to this episode with a friend. Either just click the share button or highlight the URL and send the link to this episode with a friend, because that's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. Throughout the 10 plus years of Entree Architect, that's how we've grown, architect to architect. So I would love for you to share this episode and all the episodes with one friend every week. We'd love that. And thank you to our sponsors for this episode. We don't have an episode if there's no sponsors. So thank you to our sponsors. Links to those sponsors, which you should go visit and click, and all the resources that we discussed today for this specific episode, they are all available at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Every episode that we've recorded is there, entrearchitect.com/podcast. Go click the links to the sponsors and say hello. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. You should go visit that at gablemedia.com. That is the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community. You can now earn continuing education credits for listening to select episodes of this podcast, Entree Architect Podcast. Yes, AIA CEUs for listening to a podcast. It's there, and many other podcasts are there as well. And you can listen to all of them and get credit. Learn more about our program, Gable Members Program, at the gablemedia.com/members website. That's gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, join us today at Entree Architect Network. That is the worldwide organization for small firm entrepreneur architects. If you own your own architecture firm, you are an entrepreneur architect. You are an Entree Architect. With weekly live group business coaching, yep, we have business coaching there, monthly live business training with AIA CEUs, 2 a month, so 24 AIA credits per year, including 12 of those are HSWs. We have them in the membership. Business resources, all the resources you need to run your business, special session webinars, mastermind groups, and a thriving community of small firm architects just like you. Hundreds of architects are there waiting for you to join. So we provide the support and encouragement you need to succeed as a small firm architect. I know that you haven't been trained as a business person when you launched your firm. That's what we do. Come learn how to run a business at Entree Architect Network. And today you can go join right now for free for 30 days at this link, entrearchitect.com/30days. We'll give you free 30 days for membership. Go check it out at entrearchitect.com/30days, and I will see you there. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I want you to remember 3 words: love, learn, share. Have a great day. Are you NCARB certified yet? Join the network of over 45,000 architects who have the NCARB certificate to expand your professional reach. By becoming NCARB certified, you are demonstrating that you've met the national standards for licensure, a qualification that can be an important factor for firms when hiring and promoting. Certificate holders have a streamlined path to apply for a reciprocal license in all 55 U.S. jurisdictions, as well as access to an extensive library of free continuing education courses. Learn more today at ncarb.org.